Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. 50 years ago, Oregon was the first state in the nation to establish a statewide comprehensive plan. Looking back, we can evaluate how much planning has impacted the lives of Oregonians, both geographically and demographically. Now there's a forward-looking opportunity to proactively create the conditions we envision for Oregon 25 years into the future. Joining me on the exchange is Megan Horst. She's a professor at Portland State University and editor of the new book, Toward Oregon 2050, Planning for a Better Future. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the details of the book, can you give us some background on what led to this book project?
Yeah, well, in short, some of the motivations are that we have the, you know, talented and smart profession of planners here in Oregon who are busy making plans at the local scale because of the statewide land use planning system. But professors at Portland State University had the idea that it would be great to take a more holistic statewide look, kind of a more bird's eye view to say, okay, where is this all headed? Is it headed in a direction? And, you know, there's a little bit about the timing, too. We're here in 2025, a quarter century, and this is a good time to reflect back and look forward. Are we headed in a good direction for the state? So I think the impetus was, as scholars of planning, we thought we could play a role in the state in shaping a statewide conversation and reflecting, is our land use planning system having the impacts people who started it 50 years ago hoped it would have? And if yes, let's celebrate that. And if not, well, this is a great time to have some good big ideas and change it. So that's some of the impetus.
Tell me a little bit about 50 years ago. What created the impetus for people to say, let's create a 50-year statewide plan for Oregon? How did that come about?
Yeah, I'll share a little bit, and I also encourage readers to check out a book by my colleague and fellow co-author in the book, Dr. Cy Adler, called Oregon Plans, and he really is a historian of planning and covers this in depth. But in short, today I'll say, you know, this was the early 1970s, and Oregonians of a lot of different backgrounds, a pretty diverse coalition of folks, we're talking environmentalists, farmers, urban advocates, so friends of cities, and real estate developers were some of this coalition that were looking around what was going on in the state and were worried that it wasn't the direction they wanted Oregon to go in. They were sharing concerns about rampant development, kind of unplanned, uncoordinated suburban development. And they formed an idea about a statewide land use planning program that would call for the protection of working lands, forest lands and farmlands, and that would coordinate development in existing cities or close to it, and that addressed a bunch of other issues around housing, accommodating population growth, et cetera. So this diverse coalition brought forward a plan, and it was embraced by elected officials, both Republican and Democrat, who adopted the Oregon Land Use Planning Program in the early 1970s. And it was also embraced by our very visionary governor at the time, Governor Tom McCall, who did a lot of amazing things in his era. He was a Republican and a supporter of conserving working lands, and he has this kind of great speech you can listen to. He was a great orator, and he talked about stopping sagebrush subdivisions and coastal condominia and preserving the unique character of Oregon, which we're so lucky to have, a really beautiful state. So there were definitely some interesting characters. I'm not remembering their names right now, but a farmer, Hector, I think, and others, and you can read all about that in Cy Adler's book. But it was a really unique time in Oregon's history, and a lot of diverse people coming to a shared vision for the state.
Well, I just want to be clear on the word diverse, because we're coming out of the 1960s, and these are the early 1970s. So when we talk about diversity, we're talking about, I think, socioeconomic and professional diversity. Is that what we're talking about? Not racial diversity.
Oh, thanks so much for clarifying that. Yeah, I'm talking about it. Actually, when I was talking about it, I was talking about it a little bit more politically and, yeah, professionally, like who we might think of as strange bedfellows. You don't often think of real estate developers, farmers, and environmentalists, for example, as being really aligned in their vision. So that's more the diversity. You're correct in that I'm not exactly speaking about a racial diversity coalition at the time. I'm more talking about professionally and politically.
Gotcha.
And geographically, I would say, was also a statewide supported effort. So rural dwellers as well as urban dwellers.
Right. So help me understand your personal background and what in your own life influenced you to care about this larger society around you.
Oh, I love that question. Gosh, well, I've been an urban planner since 2008 or so, and I was drawn to the profession of urban planning for a lot of different motivations. But I would say one big one was when I was a college student in the late 1990s. I was really active in environmental issues, and I was the president of the environmental club. And because of that, I got to be on a team that looked at the vision for 2050 for my campus at the time, like a 50-year plan that looked forward. And I was living in Florida, so we struggled with issues like I had just learned about climate change, and we talked about sea level rise. And we got to develop this plan where we really had concrete strategies around green buildings and a bike rental fleet program and eliminating plastics from the cafeteria and having an on-campus garden. And I just thought it was so exciting to be part of a profession and group of people that was problem-solving and visionary about the future, but with really concrete actions. So that really opened my eyes to the cool idea of planning and the role of planning and addressing environmental and social problems. And so that was one reason. And then, you know, fast forward a bunch of years, I went to grad school in Seattle at the University of Washington, got my PhD, and was so fortunate to get the opportunity to be a professor of planning at Portland State University. And I was delighted to move to Oregon, a state with a really renowned land use planning program. We're really one of the only states in the country with such a strong statewide approach to planning.
Well, you know what they say, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So it's interesting how Oregon has turned out in its current state because it was quite planned that way. Your first chapter offers a clarification around what the book is and is not. Can you explain?
Yeah. In our first chapter, we talk about how the book is a reflection looking backwards on Oregon's land use planning program. So we do kind of reflect on current trends, data points, and it is organized loosely around the 18 goals of the land use planning program. So that's one thing it is. We also note, though, that it's not explicitly an evaluation, like goal by goal of the land use planning program. In fact, we take a broader look than those 18 goals, because as planners of today in 2025, we think it's just important to take a more holistic look. One example, for the land use planning program doesn't really focus on climate change. It just wasn't an issue that was well understood in the 1970s. It is very well understood now, and so we have a chapter that really looks at climate change and other hazards explicitly. We also have chapters on arts and culture, on voting and democracy, and on mental health and substance abuse issues that are really salient today but aren't well addressed in the land use planning program. And then the other thing we do is we look forward. So it's kind of a look back to now and then a look forward to 2050, hence the title. And we, based on looking at these trends, we look forward and say, based on, you know, what's happening now, if we continue as we are under a sort of business as usual scenario, if you will, where are we headed in 2050? What does that look like? And then we as authors reflect, like, is that a good thing that we're headed that way? And we kind of offer some evaluation of that. And if not, we offer some big ideas about how to change course for a better Oregon for the future residents in 2050. And so we call it, it's not an explicit exercise in scenario planning. It's more of what we call a foresight effort. And that's where you take a good holistic scan of issues. You try to take a comprehensive analysis of it, and you try to poise yourself, and ourselves as a state, to really address those issues head on, clear-headed and clear-minded. But it's a little bit different than scenario planning, which would be a bit more of a technical exercise down to really specific issues. So we do more of this foresight approach, and we try to offer a full package of big ideas, specific to each chapter or issue, but then also kind of holistically.
My guest is Megan Horst. She's a professor at Portland State University and editor of the new book, Toward Oregon 2050, Planning for a Better Future. So, Professor, you write in the book, quote, "Oregon's history with planning is important context as we look to 2050," end quote. Why is history important?
Oh, gosh, that's another great question. Well, Oregon's history is, history is always important because you've got to know where you're coming from to know, to have some sense of where you're headed. But I think some points we make in the book are Oregon has a really unique history of policy, innovation, and experimentation that is really unique in the country. And I think the land planning program is one example, but there are others. For example, the beach bill, quite famous, and our bottle bill, both really uniquely Oregon things. We've had more recent measures, for example, around drug use and around decriminalization. We have voter reform. For example, Portland is doing ranked choice voting, which is pretty unique in the country. So we just have this interesting history in Oregon of being a state where we do things a bit differently and we're willing to innovate and experiment. And I think that's really important history. As we talk about big ideas, looking to the future, I think as Oregonians, we can kind of use that part of our identity and not feel stuck and kind of feel empowered. Like we are a state that innovates and experiments. Other states look to us to lead the way, to try things, to be different. And so that's, I think, one really important of history. Another one we talk about in the book is while we have this history of policy, innovation, and experimentation, we have to address the problems of our past, with some honesty and clear-eyedness. And a thing we talk about in the book is Oregon has a history of racial and economic exclusion and inequity. We're not alone in the country for that. That's a history common to other states. But we do have some uniquely Oregon stories that have been well discussed by scholars across the state and well discussed kind of by social organizations now. And so I think it's important to reconcile with some of our history, for example, of land from Native Americans, or we were a state that didn't allow Black people to own land for a long time. And those are histories we really need to address head on so that we can create a more equitable future for all Oregonians.
I'm glad you talked about that because in the book you write, quote, "Oregon is not alone among U.S. states in having a history rife with colonialism and white supremacy. Although Walida Imarisha and other scholars point out that Oregon is unique for having been founded as a white utopia," end quote. Has that mindset changed? And if so, when did that change occur?
Wow, that's a big question. And I would encourage folks to read Walida Imarisha's stuff. She has books and other content that are worth a deep read and other writers out there too about this. And I think, when I said Black people weren't allowed to own land, so Oregon was seen by some early settlers as a place to leave the so-called troubles of slavery behind and come to a state where really only white people were allowed to own land and live. So that's kind of some of its history, really short and rude right here. And you asked, has that changed? Well, gosh, that's a big question. I would like to think yes, in many ways, yes. I think a lot of leaders and a lot of activists and just regular Oregonians in their daily life are trying very hard to dismantle that history to create an Oregon that's a safe, welcoming place for all people to thrive. And they're doing that through changing policy, through running programs, through being a good neighbor and resident and contributing to nonprofits, things like that, to dismantling oppression at lots of levels. And, you look at the data, and we also still have a long way to go, and there are also still, unfortunately, real situations where there's racist acts and other acts like that happening. So I certainly don't think it's the fully... I don't think we have fully finished that story, unfortunately. But I do appreciate that many Oregonians are trying to address that horrific past and move to a better future.
Well, we'll have to hold it right there while we take a short break. My guest is Megan Horst. She's a professor at Portland State University and editor of the new book, Toward Oregon 2050, Planning for a Better Future. I'm Mike Green. The JX will be right back shortly. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Megan Horst. She's a professor at Portland State University and editor of the new book, Toward Oregon 2050, Planning for a Better Future. Before the break, we were talking about how this whole book project came about and some of the things that it addresses, like the history of Oregon and the challenges that we have experienced in our history, which, as the professor said, we were trending in the right direction. We're not there yet with regard to our past of racial discrimination and segregation and just outright exclusion of others. Professor, when we think of the characteristics of colonialism, we tend to think about the appropriation of land. And you have a section titled Evaluating Oregon's Land Use Program. What did you find and conclude?
Yeah, so the land use chapter in the book addresses a lot of different aspects of Oregon's land use planning program. Now, the land use planning program doesn't confront the history of colonialism head on. The goals of the land use planning program are protection of working lands, so forest and farmland, and kind of pushing of development into already developed cities and towns or right around them. And there are goals around a housing supply that meets the needs of residents and supporting economic development. So the chapter takes a broad look at, well, is the land use efforts, is it having the goals of the program? So is it helping us meet the protection of working lands and the more efficient use of our existing built-up lands? And the data is somewhat positive on this, that yes, our land use system has resulted in positive impacts. Like we have preserved more forest and farmland than many other states and relative to prior to the establishment of the program. So we're protecting farm and forest lands, and we have more efficient compact development. So for every new Oregon resident, we develop less land than other states do. So we have overall and more efficient compact development, and people tend to use more bike, walking, bus, and we have less vehicle miles traveled. So there's lots of positive impacts of the land use system. But you brought up colonialism, and what we discuss in the book is that the land use system doesn't address the racist or colonial impacts of development in Oregon prior to that. And so, for example, yes, land has been taken from Native Americans. And we do discuss in the book that the existing tribal governments in Oregon have their own systems of planning that differ from the statewide approach, and they often have more Native values around cultural stewardship and are more oriented to protection of resources than kind of white Oregon professional way. So that's one way, but there hasn't been a big effort to return land. So that's a gap we point out. And then another thing, while there have been really positive impacts, we point out in other chapters in the book that there are ongoing racial inequities in Oregon that the land use system alone has not resolved. So for example, households of color, in particular Native and Black households, are more likely to be rent burdened and cost burdened by housing in Oregon than white folks. So that's an area of a big racial inequity that's really difficult for many Oregonians.
I appreciate you addressing that point. You also write, and I quote, "As we look to 2050, there's a need for a more holistic, deeper attention to ecological stewardship to reduce our overshoot, especially as we try to halt and adapt to the worst of human-caused climate change and accommodate a growing population. It is also time to focus more attention on the social foundation of our state to more secure housing, income, and mental health for Oregonians of all socioeconomic and racial ethnic backgrounds," end quote. Professor, who is this message written for?
Yeah, good question. Our book has a number of hoped audiences. And, you know, one obvious one are incoming Oregon legislators who have a lot of power over policy that shapes our state. But other ones include leaders in business, leaders at local levels of government, of big institutions. And then we're also talking to kind of young people who are coming up who will be the leaders in 2050. And this whole message of a holistic approach to stewardship, in this book, we draw on an approach to Kate Raworth as an economist, but she has a more sustainable vision of economy that really takes, she calls it donut view, but that looks at our ecological foundation and our social foundation and tries to assess, like, where are we? And our book points out that we look to 2050, Oregon's overshooting in some of our environmental indicators, if you will. So, for example, air quality, water quality, deforestation, loss of farmland, vehicle miles traveled, carbon emissions, those sorts of things. We've got room to improve in a lot of our environmental indicators, and then definitely also in some of our social measures of well-being. And I mentioned housing. That's a really big one that many Oregonians are experiencing, that we have very unaffordable housing, and that's a big one we need to address, as well as wealth inequity, we have high rates of mental health issues that are in not a lot of mental health access. So those are some of the areas where we're achieving all this. So our audience is big in many Oregons, and just anyone who's a leader and has influence and ability to advocate for change.
My guest is Megan Horst. She's a professor at Portland State University and editor of the new book, Toward Oregon 2050, Planning for a Better Future. So, Professor, let's get a deeper understanding of how this book is laid out and how comprehensive it is. Let's walk through the chapters with a brief synopsis of each. And I know that there's 17, 18, how many chapters are there?
There's 14, yeah.
Okay, there's 14. So let's see if we can get through at least most of them. Chapter 2 is about population growth, right? 5.2 mm-hmm. million is expected, up from 4.2 million in 2021.
This chapter was written by a couple demographers, and as we look to 2050, they're anticipating, even with the impacts of COVID where population growth slowed for a while, they're still projecting or forecasting that by 2050, we're expecting another million people to live in our state through a combination of in-migration, mostly in-migration, actually, because our birth rate is quite low in Oregon. So the big challenge of the chapter is, well, how do we plan for a future with more people in it?
Right.
And I should say another main point is they point out the changing demographics of the state. Some major points as we look to 2050 is we will have a much older state, so many more people over 65, and we'll also have a much more racially diverse state. We may become closer to majority people of color by then. And if economic trends hold, we'll also probably have more people of lower income in the future. Those are all really important factors: an aging population, a population with more people of color, and more people with economic challenges. Those are all really important issues for planners to be thinking about.
So that kind of sounds like we'll have an aging white population and a growing multiracial, multicultural population that's on the lower scale of the economic ladder.
Yeah, that's a great synopsis. And I will say that last part is, where people are on the economic ladder can be influenced by, policy and efforts. So that isn't a given. We could change that and help people have better, more wealth and economic equity.
And that's why your book is written. That's why we plan, right?
Correct.
And chapter 3 is about the natural environment, about climate change. That's a big one.
Yeah. So part 1 addresses, there's 3 chapters there looking at the natural environment. In chapter 3, my colleague Connie Ozawa, it's about climate change as well as other hazards like earthquakes, and assesses Oregon as, having made some steps towards adapting to climate change and mitigating the worst of it and halting our emissions and also preparing for other hazards like earthquakes. But the big takeaway is we definitely aren't doing enough and ought to be doing more to prepare for the climate changes we're already experiencing and that are going to, be worse in the future.
And of course, that affects our environmental quality and health.
Yeah, chapter 4, Dana Hellman and Vivek Chandas wrote, and I'd say that's a little bit of an optimistic chapter. Not all the chapters are as rosy, but they actually tell a story of some improved indicators in water and air quality in our state in the last 50 years. So the results of good policy and programming, but they do point out that those are not, that there are inequities in air and water quality across the state and in communities. They have a couple of cases, for example, in Eugene, where there's some disparities. So while we're doing better than in the past on the whole in our environmental quality in a lot of ways, there's still room to improve, especially in terms of good air and water quality for everybody.
Well, on that note, the natural resource management, you had a huge dam removal, so that's about water quality, and you have forest management. Those are issues that are still being dealt with.
Yeah, those the chapter authors of that natural resource section, and that's a really important one in Oregon, a big part of our identity. They point out some positives around forest management, like you say, water quality, but they also point out ways that Oregon could be planning more strategically, looking to 2050, particularly around renewable resources and forest management in terms of, you know, healthier biodiversity and reducing risk of forest fire, as just some example.
And then we get to a huge issue that I'm not sure how it's resolved, but housing.
Yeah, my colleague Matthew Gebhardt tackles that one and covers a lot of information talking about how we got to where we are today, which is we're in a housing crisis, as probably all the listeners know. And he shares a lot of the data of that, and it's obviously affecting low-income residents the worst. They have the least access to housing and are most cost burdened. And he offers a bunch of big ideas for Oregon to tackle, including like a registry of low-income units, better tenant protections, more investment in affordable housing, and more incentives for developers. You know, the reality is we're kind of trying to do this on our own at the state level because there's not a lot of support from the federal government on this issue right now. So this is a big chapter of importance.
And of course, housing is affected by land use laws, or urban growth boundaries, zoning.
Yeah, Chapter 7, we've talked a little bit about it already. So we cover some of the positive impacts on land use, like protection of working lands and more efficient compact development. And we also point out that there's room to do better and in a particular way to really incentivize development on underused lands in already existing urban areas. I live in Portland, for example, and there's vacant lots and underused land that would be great to put some more housing in. And I think we have to, as a state, figure out how to do that more efficiently and cost-effectively. So we tackle some of that in that chapter.
And of course, getting around this state is an interesting venture. Transportation, infrastructure, roads and bridges.
Oh, yeah. John MacArthur tackles that one really holistically and talks a lot about how our transportation infrastructure and investments should really has led to a situation where many people get around by car. And there's a lot of kind of negative impact. There's both a lot of freedom in that and then some negative impacts in terms of escalating costs for people, pollution, a lot of pavement, and cost to maintain. And he offers a lot of big ideas to change. So things like more train, long distance and medium distance train, more investments in biking and walking so kids, for example, can walk to school, and ways to really offer people a wider range of options for getting around.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left, so let's try to see if we can summarize the next few chapters. Arts and culture.
Yep, Richard Klukas talks about Oregon's done some great things, and it's really a strength in our state, arts and culture, and he offers ways that the state can be a more proactive steward and supporter of our arts and culture folks in Oregon.
The economy?
Yeah, the economists in that author chapter talk about how our economy has some inequities in it, and some people are doing better than others, and wages have stagnated for the lower for lower-income earners, and they offer some ideas of how that could be changed and different ways of doing economic development than we have in the past.
And, of course, that leads to homelessness.
Yeah, we chose to address this topic separately from housing because it's such a big issue in Oregon, and the authors really tackle the causes of homelessness, a big one being lack of housing, and offered just really clear ideas about housing-first models for solving the problem.
And then there's reinvesting in rehabilitation.
Yeah, this is a public health focused chapter, really talking about the need for more mental health care and substance use disorder support for Oregonians and for rethinking our incarceration system. So this is a chapter that's really a unique addition for a land use planning program focused book.
I look forward to diving more into that one. State revenue and spending.
Yeah, we felt we couldn't tackle some big ideas without commenting on how the state gets its money and how it spends it. And one reality is a lot of the money coming into the state is already earmarked and has to be spent on certain things. So it kind of limits the big ideas. So this chapter calls for some different ideas to generate revenue to enable different spending.
And the last chapter is voting and representation. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, so we can't get into the policymaking chapter as well. But I really want to thank you for joining me on The Exchange, Professor.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
My guest is Megan Horst. She's a professor at Portland State University and editor of the new book, Toward Oregon 2050, Planning for a Better Future.